Support for WGTD and The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. Support also comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, there is yet another installment in the Marvelous American Experience series and a film called The Gilded Age. I suspect that you have at least heard that term out of America's own past, but maybe don't have a clear understanding of exactly when the Gilded Age was and what that term really represents. The term refers to the late 19th century and to that period of explosive growth in America when we really became a true economic powerhouse in so many respects. And this is also a period in our history in which there was a sort of growing divide between the extremely wealthy and the struggling masses. And so this is a timely conversation because, of course, we are living in an age today in which there is a very similar sort of divide and also a fairly sharp division in terms of perspective on what that divide means and whether or not that's a terrible thing or a healthy thing or an inescapable thing or a situation which should be addressed by the government or in other ways. This program, The Gilded Age, again, examines the late 19th century, and it draws upon the expertise of a number of special guests, including my guest for the morning show today, Dr. Edward T. O'Donnell, who is Associate Professor of History at Holy Cross College. He is the author of a number of different books, including a very interesting book about one of the Americans who is discussed in this documentary, Henry George. His Professor O'Donnell's book is Henry George and the Crisis of Inequality. He has several other books to his credit and also keeps a very interesting blog called In the Past Lane, Your Highway to History, which I have enjoyed looking at. Again, we're talking today, the day before this American Experience documentary airs called The Gilded Age. Professor Edward O'Donnell, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be with you.
Real quick, before we get to the film and your contribution to it, I'd love to hear a little bit about what first enticed you to become so interested in history. And I'd also love to know a little bit about what it's like for you to teach at what I believe is your own alma mater, Holy
That's
Cross
right.
College.
Yeah, well, I guess the simplest way to say why I became a historian is that I failed chemistry in my freshman year of college. So the original plan, which was to follow the steps of my father and my older brother to become a doctor, those were sort of blown up by my own incompetence in the sciences. But I always knew that I loved history. Both my father and my brother were history majors who went on to become doctors. So I just went with stick with just the history part and become a professor. So I've always had a deep, abiding interest in history. My mother was also a history major when she went to college. So I think it kind of ran in the family. We lived in New England, so we hit a lot of historic sites and, you know, battlefields and all of that as we were growing up.
Is the period covered in this documentary, the so-called Gilded Age, has that been an area of particular focus for you, or just in general have you examined the full scope of American history?
Well, I think when you train to become a historian in American history, you are trained to teach, you know, what we call the survey course, you know, from Columbus or pre-Columbus up to the present day. And so I've taught those kinds of, you know, US 1, US 2 courses, and you really need to have a good sense of the whole sweep of American history, not to mention other areas of history as well, like European history and world history. But I think the period of the Gilded Age, it didn't initially captivate me. I think I was more captivated with Henry George and this idea of the reform tradition in American history. So I was interested in abolitionists and women's rights activists, and Henry George just turned out to be one of these really interesting people who fit that profile of somebody who saw social problems and worked hard to call attention to it and to warn people that if this issue, whether, in this case it was rampant inequality, if it's unaddressed, then the republic that we love and hold dear is going to disintegrate. So, and as I got into Henry George, I really became even more captivated and interested in the Gilded Age as a historical time period, really the period when America, when modern America was born. The things that we recognize as part of modern America today are really all sort of have their origin point, or certainly their flowering point, in the Gilded Age.
Hmm. I appreciated that someone in the film, I believe it's another of the expert contributors weighing in, towards the very beginning of the film, talks about why that term, the Gilded Age, is such a perfect term for this period, because when we talk about something that is gilded, we are typically talking about something in which there is a patina that is covering something else. In other words, it's not a solid gold sphere. It's a sphere made of something else, and then there is gold sort of painted upon it. In the opinion of this particular expert, that's a really good way to think about this particular era of American history, which at a glance might represent one thing, but actually represents this other thing as well. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think anybody who studies the Gilded Age, which we should probably clarify, is it doesn't have a precise beginning and end point, but so I usually just say the last third of the 19th century. And anybody who studies that period as a historian typically likes that phrase, Gilded Age, because it's coined by Mark Twain in the early part of the Gilded Age. It's the title of one of his novels. But it does provide that perfect metaphor, because there's no question that if you look at what is exciting people about the Gilded Age, it's an age of an unbelievable optimism and joy and confidence about where the nation is heading. It's all about progress, 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 and new technology and expansion. And if you look just at the stats regarding the economy is growing by leaps and bounds. We basically go from being a mid-tier country to the world's foremost industrial power by 1900. And that happens in like four decades. So there's a lot to be excited about. And there is a lot of gold, no question. But beneath the surface, beneath all that progress and all that wealth, are some raging social problems. And that's what I think it was historian Nell Painter. She's the one who very deftly describes that idea of a patina of gold covering something that's quite ugly.
Right.
And that's really, what we see is that amidst all this new technology and all this wealth expansion and really transformation of life, there are millions and millions of Americans who are falling into poverty. There's raging controversies about immigration. There are thousands and thousands of strikes that really alarm people, because we don't associate strikes on this scale with the United States. In the late 19th century, people thought that's what Europeans do. We don't have classes in America. We don't have class conflict in America. And yet there it was on the streets of every major city and any town that had any kind of industrial business.
Mm. I think someone else in this portion of the film refers to the United States almost being two nations, both dwelling within the same national borders, but essentially two nations, two populations, because we're talking about two such disparate realities.
Yeah, and you can see it in very close proximity. So, and people commented on this. They would say, if you want to see the two Americas, go to New York. And you can go up Fifth Avenue, which is the avenue of all the millionaires, the Vanderbilts and Carnegie, and all of those folks have built these incredible mansions, really palaces, to be truthful. But if you went just downtown a couple miles, you'd go from Fifth Avenue to a place called Five Points, which was probably the nation's, if not the world's, most famous slum on the Lower East Side. And you'd find just by 1890, there's something, I don't know the stats, I don't have them at hand, but it's the most densely populated place in the world. And it's full of poor people living in six-story tenements without running water and lots of misery and lots of social problems associated with that misery. So it's those people don't look, you know, to a person that imagines what's the ideal sort of humble, everyday American. Those people look like European peasants, you know, ground into the ground by an unequal society. So it's quite alarming to people to imagine that the United States is moving in that direction, sort of sliding back to a European-style society.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Professor Edward T. O'Donnell, who is one of the expert contributors to the American Experience documentary that is airing tomorrow night on PBS. The program is called The Gilded Age, and that term refers to, and the film covers, the last several decades of the 19th century in the United States, a period of spectacular growth, but also a period in which a lot of, in a sense, civil unrest or social unrest emerged and was began to be understood for the first time. The film makes very, very clear that the spectacular growth of the United States in so many ways hinged upon the emergence of the railroad. Could you talk for a moment about the way in which the railroad itself utterly transformed this country?
Yes, that's one of my favorite things to point out, particularly with my students, is that when they think of, and most Americans of any age, when they think of a steam locomotive, they think of it as kind of this quaint, old-fashioned-y thing. And the only time you see a steam railroad these days is at some sort of, you know, museum, outdoor museum, or, you know, historic site where you take your grandchildren on the railroad and it goes 5 miles an hour in a one-mile loop and ends up at the gift shop. That's what the railroad is now. But in the late 19th century, the railroad is the space shuttle, it's the super collider, it's the most advanced form of technology on the planet, and it is transforming everything about everyday life in terms of movement of people, of information. It's using the most cutting-edge materials, including, you know, the one material, if you had to boil it down to one material in the late 19th century, in the Gilded Age, that transformed everything, it's steel. In the same way that the silicon chip has transformed everything in the last 40 years where we have been living. And so the railroad has this incredible transformative power, but it's, you know, looked at from another angle, it's also the first big business. It's the first real, full-blown, multi-state corporation. And all the rules of what the heck an industrial corporation is and how it operates are really devised by the railroad. How do you operate over thousands of miles? How do you have tens of thousands of employees? How do you generate the capital, the millions of dollars, it'd be billions of dollars in our time? How do you generate that kind of money? Where does it come from in order to lay tracks and to build, you know, expand your empire? So the railroad is really, even if you never ride the railroad in the Gilded Age, it's changing the world all around you. And just to provide one other example, you know, one of the people featured in the document sort of highlighted, along with Henry George, is Mary Elizabeth Lease. And she's known as one of these fiery populists in the late 19th century, representing the interests of farmers. Farmers who we don't necessarily associate with the railroad are really being pinched by the forces of this new industrial economy. And, you know, they know that if they grow a bumper crop of corn or a bumper crop of rye or whatever it is that they're raising, that's all in, you know, that looks like going to be a good year for them, but they've got to sell that or transport that product by railroad. And the railroad is a monopoly, and it can charge any price that it wants. And so these farmers feel that their hard work that raised that product is being skimmed off, being gouged by these larger corporations, and all of which, you know, end up pointing the finger at Wall Street, since Wall Street seems to control these large corporations.
Hmm. One of the things that hadn't really dawned on me about the early railroad and the way which it changed our country is, I mean, I had some sense that what was really important was the way it would transport goods, but the film also mentions that it was the railroad that really helped facilitate and also to some extent, I suppose, necessitate the sweeping urban immigration that occurred. That is, not immigrants coming from outside the country, but in a sense, rural Americans immigrating to urban America.
That's right.
To its metropolitan centers, and the fact that that occurred in such a widespread way, that also made such a difference then in how life itself changed for so many Americans.
Yes, the railroad allows people to move in almost any direction. And then there's also a smaller version of the railroad, which are streetcars and horse cars and all the urban transportation systems. So you have lots of rural Americans realizing or deciding that they have a better opportunity by moving to a big city. And big cities can accommodate them because food grown thousands of miles away can be brought to the city. Nobody in the city raises food, or certainly very few people do, so that you can overcome that problem. And cities now can grow to limitless, just really any size, 1 million, 2 million. New York City reaches almost 4 million people by 1900. And that's only possible because there is a whole railroad network that's bringing food and products to New York. But then within New York City, you can actually have a functioning, gigantic city of almost, 400 square miles, because you've got this internal web of subways and streetcars and elevated railroads that move people and goods and information around. So it's there's a micro level to it and there's a macro level to it as well.
Hmm. Before we get to the populists, who are a very, very important part of this film and an important part of this period, although certainly their names are not nearly so well known as the names we're about to talk about. Before we get to those populists, let's talk about some of these really insanely wealthy Americans who, in so many respects, dominate the headlines and also dominate sort of our view of this era. I mean, when we think about the Gilded Age, we think about people with names like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Vanderbilt. Describe just, first of all, the scope of their wealth and the scope of their influence during this period in our history.
Yeah, all those names you mentioned all are people that acquire just really unimaginable fortunes. So in our day, there's people like Bill Gates, and most people think Bill Gates is probably worth somewhere around $75 billion, that's with a B. And there's very few people close to him in terms of aggregate wealth. But if you were to take John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and Andrew Carnegie in their day, and then take their fortunes and update them in terms of what the cash value of their fortune in, say, 1900 was today, Bill Gates would be fourth on that list. So Rockefeller's, in today's dollars, Rockefeller's fortune is $253 billion.
Hmm.
Vanderbilt's was $205, and Carnegie's $101 billion. And so that's to give you an idea of scale. And that, of course, one of the reasons for that big differential is there's no income tax in the days of these industrialists, who their critics, of course, called robber barons. So their power is immense. And this is what really raises the big questions in the Gilded Age, because it's not just poor workers or struggling farmers who feel like the rich are getting away with, are becoming too rich and powerful, but it's also middle class and even upper middle class people who are concerned. So if people, if you remember from your days of taking history and seeing really colorful cartoons from the late 19th century depicting robber barons as in the shape of money bags and all of that, those are very, very common cartoons. But those are not in labor union magazines. Those are in, Puck magazine and Harper's Weekly and publications like Judge. These are very popular middle-class American publications. So many people were worried about the immense political power that came with that wealth. It wasn't just that these guys were super rich. It was that everybody knows that with that wealth comes stupendous political influence.
Mm. And you couple those things together, and somebody becomes all but unstoppable. I especially appreciated the way in which the film helps us understand some of the ways in which Andrew Carnegie really revolutionized, for instance, the steel industry, particularly in the construction of this massive steel plant just outside of Pittsburgh. Is that Homestead?
Yes.
Homestead. Can you just say a word about some of the ways in which Andrew Carnegie was not only sort of riding the crest of the wave, but also really leading the charge. I mean, as a real visionary.
Well, Carnegie is this remarkable figure. You know, if you had to choose one figure to sort of represent at least a lot of the Gilded Age, it would definitely be Andrew Carnegie, because he's not only, you know, super wealthy like Vanderbilt, but he's also got the immigrant background story, the rags to riches part of it, which also makes him all that more interesting. And he, you know, we were talking about railroads earlier. What is the first business that Carnegie gets into? It's railroads. He becomes essentially a secretary to a railroad president, and then becomes a manager of a railroad. And so all the corporate knowledge that he acquires comes from working on the first corporations, these big railroads. And so he'll start to apply that to the steel industry. And he doesn't invent the steel industry, but he takes it from this highly splintered, you know, small-scale production business and creates this highly capitalized, centralized, massive steelworks where he can get all these great economies of scale. And he often said, I don't really know much about how to make steel. I know how to hire the experts who know how to make steel, and I know how to organize things, and I know how to cut deals. And that's really what he brings to it, this kind of larger expertise, and gets the right people working for him and becomes, you know, the richest man in America, or one of the richest men in America, by the time he retires in 1901.
Right. I also appreciate the point made that Andrew Carnegie is going after this massive expansion at a time when actually America is suffering through a serious recession, maybe even a depression of sorts. But Andrew Carnegie knows that the future is going to be built on steel, and that all kinds of things, all kinds of structures, bridges, buildings, and so on, are going to be rebuilt in steel. And so at a time when others in the industry are hesitant and pulling back, he is moving forward boldly, and that makes all the difference in the world.
The Gilded Age is racked by two great depressions. So if we didn't have our own Great Depression in the 1930s, we would be referring to either one of those as the Great Depression. That's from 1873 to 1877, and then again 1893 to 1897. These are, you know, just total collapses of the national economy. 25% unemployment, tens of thousands of businesses fail, people actually starving, you know, suffering from starvation. So it's very, very difficult times, and most business people recoil in those conditions. Their orders shrink, and their ability to, you know, pay their loans shrinks. Carnegie, you know, gets into the steel business in the middle of this first Great Depression in the 1870s, and takes advantage of other people's weakness, and, you know, buys things cheaply, buys other operations cheaply, and has that confidence. Steel is the wave of the future. This is the age of steel. And when the second depression hits in the 1890s, he's already very, very powerful. And he again treats the depression as an opportunity to expand his operations, which he does.
Of course, with this almost frantic expansion and growth, the film makes the point that you have to have people willing to work brutally long hours for meager pay. I mean, that is the only way that such spectacular growth is possible. So this spectacular growth and this spectacular expanse of wealth really occurs on the backs of all kinds of men and women and even children working in the harshest of work environments. Just say a word about what it was like to be such a worker at this point in our history, and in particular, what was not in place to safeguard their safety and comfort.
Well, it's the ultimate laissez-faire, almost libertarian kind of world. So in the late 19th century, there are no rules about there's nothing that constitutes minimum wage. You can pay somebody 1 cent a day if you can get away with it. There are no rules about how long somebody needs to work. So your work day in your factory could be 8 hours, another person's could be 12, another person's could be 16 hours. 16 hours working in a factory 7 days a week. And if you complained, you could be fired. There were no rules protecting unions. So if you tried to form a union, your employer could spy on you and fire you for forming a union. So there's all the advantages in the hands of the industrialist, and there's no real advantage, no leverage in the hands of American workers. And so with that in place, guess what happens? People get paid the lowest possible wage. This is also an age of mass immigration, so industrialists know that they have an unlimited supply of cheap labor, and they take full advantage of that. And that's what really a lot of the unrest is about. And if you want just one metric to understand the unrest, in between 1880 and 1900, so just two decades, there are 37,000 strikes. Now, in all of American history up to that point, there probably were 1,000 strikes. And in that 20-year period, you have 37,000. So clearly, from top to bottom, workers are feeling on some level that they are being crushed, that their opportunities for advancement are being constricted, that their children need to be pulled out of school in order to keep the family afloat, which is, going to ruin their prospects. And again, so I gave you one metric, which is all those strikes. But another sort of way to see what's going on here is that Labor Day is invented as a holiday in 1882. Workers come together and say, we need to really, A, show people that we are the heart and soul of America and all the prosperity is due to us, and B, we need to have a way to voice our grievances about low pay, long hours, unsafe conditions. And so Labor Day is invented, and the first Labor Day celebration happens in September of 1882 in New York. And then further evidence of how popular this sentiment was, these lists of grievances, it catches on all across the country almost instantly. And by the 1890s, it's a federal holiday.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember reading about this in your blog called In the Past Lane. You write, on that day, September 5th, 1882, thousands of workers in New York City risked getting fired for taking an unauthorized day off to participate in festivities honoring honest toils and the rights of labor.
Right.
And I don't think there are many people who understand the origins of what we now think of as a nice, lazy day of leisure.
Right, the day of not working. And just to point out to your listeners, I have that blog, but that blog is also, probably more so now, a podcast by the same name, In the Past Lane.
Oh, right.
Take up to topics in history and interview historians. In fact, I'll have a few episodes about the Gilded Age that'll be leading up to the February 6th airing of the documentary.
Wonderful. So those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Edward T. O'Donnell, a history professor at Holy Cross College and one of the contributors to the PBS documentary, The Gilded Age, airing tomorrow night on the PBS series, The Gilded Age, on the series, The American Experience. So there is, as someone says in the film, a sense of shared peril that breeds the solidarity necessary to form important and powerful unions in our country. And at the heart of this movement is this charismatic figure of Henry George, someone whom you have written extensively about. And he is a person with, in a sense, sort of a complicated sort of personal profile that makes him all the more compelling. Tell our listeners about this now largely forgotten American who was so important in this period.
Yeah, Henry George is largely forgotten, but he keeps coming back. And it's sort of a reflection of, why people, really of the last 20 years, people have been sort of asking the kind of troubling question, are we now, 1990s into the 2000s, are we now in a second Gilded Age? And Henry George keeps coming back. There were two articles. There was an article in Forbes, and there was an article, I think, in the Wall Street Journal about Henry George just in the last, say, 8 or 9 months. So he keeps coming back as this kind of touchstone figure. And his story is quite interesting. He grows up in a lower middle-class house in Philadelphia. He's not a very good student, so he becomes a typesetter, which is a skilled profession. Like a lot of young Americans in the 1850s, he heads out west to make his fortune in California, and that doesn't work out. But because he's a typesetter, he has skills. He can get into the newspaper industry, and that leads him. He's very smart, even though he's not a good student. And he gets into, eventually becomes an editor. And by the 1870s, he's a pretty well-known reform-oriented editor in California, and he decides that he's going to write a book. This is also once the Great Depression of the 1870s hits. And he says, why with all this prosperity do we have these cataclysmic recessions and depressions? And why do we see with all this progress so much poverty? It seems to be growing, not shrinking in the midst of all this progress. So he sits down. This is a guy with a sixth grade education, reads every book he can get his hands on economics, and writes a 500-page book on what's wrong with the American economy and what we need to do to fix it, not just to fix the economy, but to save our Republican system, our democracy. And the book is called Progress and Poverty, and it comes out in 1879. And at that moment, there's little chance we'd ever be talking about it, but it turns out to be a great bestseller. It's still being purchased today. It's in like 20-something languages. And so Henry George, you know, what really attracted people to his message was not so much his solution, which was this kind of strange single tax idea. I mean, it's a very compelling idea, but it never quite fully explained that was going to solve everything. But what really attracted people was his diagnosis, not his prescription. And his diagnosis was inequality is surging, and you cannot have a Republican form of government. You cannot have a democracy when inequality goes above a certain level. We know we're not going to ever have a society of equals. If we have extreme inequality, that is going to send us over the cliff. Our republic will disintegrate like all the republics before it. And we can solve this problem now, or we can just let it unfold, and we will see our republic disintegrate. So he became one of these great voices of reform in the Gilded Age.
Right. And he ends up being what amounts to a third-party candidate for the office of mayor of New York City. And describe how this election ends up going.
Yeah, it's a moment. There's a couple of moments in the Gilded Age that really kind of capture the unrest. And I've already given you some statistics and some other incidents. But 1886 is one of the top 10 most tumultuous years in American history. It's lots of strikes. There's the Haymarket bombing in May of 1886. And there's also a huge crackdown all across the country by local law enforcement and local governments against unions. So they begin arresting labor union leaders and doing all kinds of things to really kind of put down this rising labor activism. And so as a consequence, there's a lot of pushback, and that comes in the form of labor parties. So lots and hundreds of communities across the country create labor parties, third parties, and run them in their local elections. And the one that really stands out is Henry George running as a member of the United Labor Party in New York for mayor of 1886. And in that era, a Labor Party candidate typically was a protest candidate. You know, he'd get 300 votes, and that would be that, just be more symbolic than anything else. Henry George gets 68,000 votes. He finishes second in the race. And the third place finisher was a guy you may have heard of named Theodore Roosevelt. So, you know, he rides that wave of popular unrest and nearly wins the mayoralty of New York City.
And this is a clear indication of just how powerful this sentiment is in the general populace. And before we run out of time, someone else I want you to talk about is someone who's already been briefly mentioned in this interview, namely a woman by the name of Mary Elizabeth Lease, whose voice is a very compelling voice indeed during this so-called Gilded Age.
Right. So unrest is felt all across the country, including out in the heartland. And farmers feel as though that they're being left behind by all this wealth that's being created. It's falling into the hands of bankers and industrialists and other people that aren't really the heart and soul of the country. You know, they're not the bricklayers in the cities, and they're not the farmers in the countryside. And so Mary Elizabeth Lease is one of these farmers out there in the heartland who has experienced all this, you know, boom and bust and losing their family farm and so forth. And so she becomes part of – there's a whole long history of farmers' alliances and organizations that are forming to kind of unify farmers, almost like a labor union, but on a, you know, much more bigger geographical scale. And the end result is a formulation of the People's Party. And the People's Party, you know, rises in the late 1880s into the early 1890s. And Mary Elizabeth Lease becomes one of these great fiery speakers. She's famous for saying that American farmers should raise more hell and less corn. You know, I mean, they should, you know, raise less corn because that'll bring the prices up, and also raise more hell because they need to make their voices known. They need to exert political power in order to beat back these other forces that have seemed to have taken over the political system.
Can you just say a word about how a woman could have such prominence at this point in our history? That's one thing that the film does not particularly explore, but it came as such a surprise to me. Is there any way to explain that?
I can take a stab at it, and this is, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, one, she had the skills. She was very smart, and she was a very quite an amazing order. So once she gave one speech, people said she's the real deal, and it you know, didn't take long for her to get on essentially a populist lecture circuit. But if you think about this late 19th century period, where are women gaining the greatest amount of success when it comes to women's rights and specifically women's suffrage? It's out in Western states. So there's something about the political structure and the ethos of Western America that allows for women to acquire greater measures of equality and maybe, you know, more space in which to make to get a chance to give a speech. And then in some ways it becomes a novelty too. There's a certain novelty of seeing a woman in a largely what is considered to be a male role and carrying it off with such incredible success. And she has a counterpart in labor. You know, there are various women in the labor movement who become, you know, Mother Jones is a famous labor activist who's going to emerge in roughly the same period, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. So there is space in this period for a charismatic woman to be, you know, a really central part of these movements.
Well, the film goes on, of course, to describe how this period tends to play out as we approach the turn of the century. And it is a powerful movement, but a movement that also suffers setbacks as well. And in a sense, we are left at the end with kind of an unsettling sense that that nothing is really resolved with any finality, although certainly there are encouraging signs. Where does the end of the Gilded Age sort of leave America?
Well, in the simplest terms, if you look at your American history textbook, the chapter that comes next is called the Progressive Era. So there is this moment of this. What we see happening is a lot of unrest and a lot of evident problems amidst all this progress in the late 19th century. And it's followed by a period in which that progress continues, but that there's a widespread movement for people, you know, whether it's talking about changing labor laws or regulating banks more vigorously, breaking up giant trusts and all of that. And that becomes part of the what we call the Progressive Era, roughly 1900 to 1920. It's almost hard to catalog the number of ways in which reform practices are implemented across the board. And one way to measure it is, you know, there are four constitutional amendments passed and ratified in that 20-year period. So a lot of American history is marked by these episodic sort of explosions of reform, where it's new developments, whether it's the development of slavery or it's the development of industrialization. There's followed by these movements in which we try to rein that in a little bit in the name of democracy, in the name of keeping a level playing field, in the name of not equality, but keeping a greater degree of equal measure of opportunity for the average American.
Vexing challenges for sure, and fascinating questions. And we should also mention that this film is not only about the struggle of workers, but it's also a really intriguing examination of what life was like at the very, very top of American society with these spectacularly wealthy individuals who lived lives we can scarcely imagine. The documentary, again, is called The Gilded Age, part of the PBS series American Experience, airing tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And one of the contributors to this fascinating film, Professor Edward T. O'Donnell. Professor O'Donnell, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to talk with you. I appreciated your contribution very much to this wonderful film. Best wishes.
Thank you. Glad to do it. It was very enjoyable on my part as well.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's morning show by interview a number of years ago, which I did with Charles D. Cohen, the author of a book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel, published by Random House. In the book, Charles Cohen explores the varied career of Theodore Geisel, who of course went on to become one of the best known and most admired authors of children's books in history. One of the most interesting things which Charles Cohen does in his book is trace the development of certain iconic Dr. Seuss stories, like Horton Hatches the Egg.
It's a great story. He people would ask him, of course, how he came up with his ideas. And one of the ones he told was about Howard and Hatch's The Egg. And he varied it over 30, 35 years, which was the first thing that led me to believe that it probably wasn't exactly the truth. Again, he's a wonderful storyteller, and he enjoyed that more than he enjoyed the truth often. So the basic story was that he had a sketch of an elephant, a sketch of a tree, and what he told his biographers in 1995, who were friends of his for 30 years and enjoyed hearing his stories, Judith and Neil Morgan, that he told them that he left the window open, went out for a walk on the day after New Year's in 1940, and then when he came back, the wind had blown one sketch on top of the other, and he came back and saw the elephant in the tree, and bingo, he's got this great idea. But if you do the research and say, well, wait a minute, there are a lot of versions. Let me track down the facts of this story. Go to the New York Times and find out that actually the temperature that day was -5 degrees with the wind chill outside his apartment. It's not window up and go for a walk weather. And he had told that same anecdote several years earlier, and it was happening in the spring, summer area. So it's a lot of fun to go through first and find out, okay, that isn't true, so now what really did happen? And that particular story developed over a 10-year period, and we try to show through some of the 700 images that we have in this book the progression, the way he would work with different animals out of context, a whale up in a tree or different animals with eggs. You get to the point where at one point you have an elephant on an egg and it just smashes it. 2 years before the book actually came out, he did a story called Matilda, the Elephant with a Mother Complex, and it's the exact same story that we're familiar with, of the elephant and the bird flying off and the elephant trying to hatch the egg, but has the exact opposite outcome. In the end, they think Matilda's an idiot for trying to hatch this egg. The bird flies off with no gratitude, the child, that is. So you can see that no matter what he told as the story, it's very clear that he was working and honing and changing this idea until he got to the great story we now remember.
It's good that you give us that fable, Matilda the Elephant with a Mother Complex, in its entirety. It's actually mostly text with really just two illustrations and then a moral at the very end of it. Moral, don't go around hatching other folks' eggs.
It's great to be speaking with someone, by the way, who has seen the book since it comes out today. It's wonderful that someone's been able to already read some and hopefully enjoy it.
Oh, it's a sheer delight. It really, really is. And it is really, in particular, so fun to see the evolution of certain ideas when all we know is the finished form,
exactly.
The book which ended up in our hands as youngsters, to see the twists and turns that the story took as it evolved over time. You've done all of us a real service here.
Thank you. And what you were saying about the pleasure of being able to see the whole piece, I think that's important if you're really going to get an understanding. And the book itself, when you're dealing with a biography, tends to be geared above the average child's interest, although he, as an author, is of interest to children. So I wanted to have things that people could read to kids, like that story, or later in the book, the other one that we were able to publish in its entirety that people wouldn't be familiar with is called Speedy Boy, and we published portions of other really fun stories that people have forgotten about because they were never published again in books. There's a story called Tad and Todd about identical twins. Some of them are just marvelous, and I really felt this as we got into all the research and things for the book. It was this feeling of responsibility that came up to not let these things be lost to time.
We're speaking with Charles D. Cohen, and we're talking about his book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. You at some point in the book take great pains to say that this is not a thorough biography of Theodore Geisel, and yet you do give us some helpful background information on who he was, his family, where he grew up, and in particular, I found interesting the influence which perhaps played on his young creative mind by a certain children's author whose books he apparently read, with the last name of Belloc, B-E-L-L-O-C. I didn't know this name. But when I read Dr. Seuss, I just think there's never been anybody like Dr. Seuss before, but indeed there sort of was.
Well, I wouldn't say that Belloc was a predecessor of that ilk. I think you'd find Charles Lutwidge Dodson, or Lewis Carroll, rather, would be more of the type of predecessor people would recognize. But he took things from different authors because he had this really peculiar memory. he couldn't forget certain things, particularly images. So with the Belloc books, it wasn't so much the text, which was more of a moralistic teach kids to behave sort of thing, but he remembered the images that Basil Blackwood, or BTB is the artist that did those, he remembered those images. I think you probably remember the images of the goat on atop the mountain. It was just a throwaway image. I have no idea why that stuck with him, but he reproduces that throughout his entire life, and there's probably 50 examples of it.
Hmm. Well, I was thinking, too, you mentioned the fact that Belloc liked to often make up names or words in order to finish out a rhyme.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, that's also a familiar hallmark of a lot of Dr. Seuss's works.
Yes, clearly. He absorbed all of these things, as well as from other children's authors. Peter Newell, who did the whole book, for example, he got a certain playfulness out of them, and he did learn things like creating words, obviously. But I think you'd agree, he took it to a whole different level when he
own
work.
Well, and you say that he sort of rebelled against the what you call kind of the puritanical tone of a lot of that children's literature. I mean, he might have taken visual images or certain styles of writing from it, but then it was towards the end of a wholly different and refreshing sort of moral or point to the story.
Yes, clearly. As a matter of fact, I've learned that in England and in Canada in particular, Dr. Seuss has sort of this anarchic persona. People really like this countercultural sort of feel that they get from him. And at first, I thought it might just have to do with a character like the Cat in the Hat, who isn't your traditional character, allows people to mess up a house rather than teaching them to keep it clean. But it was more than that. When you look at it fundamentally, he has this slightly anti-authoritarian influence where any character in power, whether it be a teacher or particularly any ruler, a king, whether it's the Kingdom of Did or whether it's Yertle as a non-human ruler, they're either idiots or they're incompetent, and it takes a kid to come along and show them the right way, show them how things should be done. I think that people appreciate that part of it as being a different take, a refreshing take, and a more normal take. I mean, the Dick and Jane series that people are used to reading back at that time, they're like sickly sweet kids. Nobody's like that.
Hmm.
So you get a whole different sort of version. And then, again, the types of things he's teaching them, once he gets their attention, to the idea of tolerance, that the person's a person no matter how small, that it doesn't matter if you have a star on your belly or not, that we should be tolerant and fight against prejudice. And what more important things for the fate of the world, if you will, would you want to teach a child?
Charles D. Cohen, his fascinating book is called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, A Visual Biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, among other things, we'll be speaking with Laura Cox, who is one of the participants in an event coming up this coming weekend dealing with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is an event that brings together a number of people who work on this issue. Laura Cox happens to come at it as someone who does acupuncture. But we'll talk about other means by which people dealing with PTSD can find relief. We'll also talk to the co-authors of a book about happy marriage called Happy Together. On Wednesday for Black History Month, you'll hear the interview I recorded with Melba Petillo Beals. She happens to be one of the 9 people from Little Rock, Arkansas, known as the Little Rock Nine. They very courageously walked into an otherwise all-white high school as part of U.S. Supreme Court-ordered integration of the schools in Little Rock. It was a very dramatic moment in dramatic history. Melba Petillo Beals has just written a book about that experience, which is intended for young readers. On Thursday, Racine Mayor Corey Mason will be in our studios along with Nan Calvert to talk about a wide array of issues confronting the city of Racine. We look forward to that very much. And on Friday, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, director of the Carthage Choir, which is just back from a very exciting tour of Europe, which took them to Budapest, Rome, and